This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'd like to welcome to our Gathering Heritage project historian Noel Sharkey. Now, Noel is going to talk to me today about the Mary Stoddart disaster. And this is something that an awful lot of people know a bit about, but we are hoping that by the end of our little chat that everyone will know an awful lot more about it. Noel, tell me a little bit about, though, way back then, what did Blackrock look like?
Well, around 1858, Blackrock was a small village with thatched fishermen's cottages along the shorefront. And these were augmented by some guest houses and hotels. The demand for such guest houses, and indeed for appropriate stabling, was driven by the local gentry and the landed classes who organised and ran horse races on the Strand. The hay ground of what is now the Marine Court complex formed the grandstand. There had been some disturbances at these some years earlier, and it wasn't a damn right. One of the local papers, in Uri Examiner, there was a sort of a drunken brawl at one of the races, but described that the following year that the less enlightened classes weren't heavily represented.
So was there much employment and that for people that lived in Blackrock with the sea there?
With the sea, all employment was related to the sea in Blackrock. At that time, there was around 400 people. Employed either directly or indirectly in the fishing industry. Fishing, the women wheeled the fish into Dundalk to sell them. Catherine Richardson, who was born in 1846 and lived till 1948, and at our 100th birthday, she recited a poem on the Mary Stoddart to a packed audience in the skating hall. Catherine Richardson describes as a young girl, as a young teenager, she wheeled carts of fish into Dundalk.
So was there, did the gentry and the poor people, let's put it that way, people that wasn't well off, basically that's what was along the front?
It was along the front, yes.
It was. Now, the whole thing, Noel, changed completely in April in 1858. The whole village got involved in this, and it didn't mean anything with gentries or people. Place got involved.
It did.
Would you tell me, Noel, a little bit about the Mary Stoddart and what we are going to tell the story about?
Yes, the Mary Stoddart was a barque, it was a low hull boat, and she came out of Scarborough, and she was named after Joseph Sanderson, the shipbuilder. She was named after his wife. She was Mary Stoddart, Nee Stoddart. She was her maiden name. She was caught in a storm. The Mary Stoddart was caught in a violent storm, and she slowly crawled her way into Dundalk Bay under escort. But she had a terrible sea beating on her beam, in other words, a right angle to the vessel's length. And it took 6 hours to complete the haul her in and to get her anchored in Dundalk Bay.
What was she coming to Dundalk for, though?
She had been in Alexandria in Egypt and in Malta, and she crossed the Mediterranean. And crossing then up the Irish Sea, she was blown off course with the storm. And she headed for the first harbour she came to, which just happened to be Dundalk, as far as I can gather. She was anchored there overnight, and she was too deep to be brought into Dundalk Bay because she was 19 and a half foot deep and 114 foot long and 28 foot wide. She weighed some 516 tonnes. Now, they couldn't take her in. Dundalk Bay was too shallow. The plan was that when she was anchored off the bay, that they would escort her out to Carlingford Lock the next day, which had deeper water and where she'd be anchored and berthed safely throughout the duration of the storm. In those days, you would have had no meteorological guidance as to the duration that a storm was likely to last. And we'd have not have known, but the plan was to get her to Carlingford Lock and there berthed and anchored safely till she could make her way back.
So when they arrived, there was no huge storm like...
The storm lasted a week. This was the thing about the storm. But the problem with the Mary Stoddart was she broke anchor the next day. And this is where the great tragedy occurs because, and indeed the testimony of Edward Tipping of Tipping's Mount, who was watching the whole affair through a telescope. He was watching the shipping. Several ships were lost during that storm. But had the Mary Stoddart lowered her masts, she might not have been pulled away. it was customary to do so, reduce her yards, but to lower her mass in layman's terms. And had she done so, there was also the captain and the crew could have been taken off, but the captain decided to stay on the ship. And this is not dealt with in any great length in any of the articles on it. But so you have a double whammy. You have the fact that the crew could have been taken off, but they didn't realise, they thought they'd be brought safely the next day to Carlingford, and she didn't lower her mast. Had she done so, she would not have been carried as far. And the problem was, when she broke anchor, she drifted out further out, and she was then below high tide level. So she was 5 or 6 foot below high tide level. So the men had to climb and tie themselves to the mast when the tide rose and came in. Mm-hmm. They were freezing to death on the bars and the sails and that. And there were three. She had three sails. One of them was slowly collapsing. Now, if the other two collapsed, the men were going to drown anyway. So there were frantic attempts made to rescue them. From the offset. 11 attempts were made in all.
So, Noel, how did they contact the people in Black Rock to say they were in
trouble?
They
would have seen it. There were several men watching the ship.
So it was visible from...
From a telescope, you know. And then, you see, there were boats going out to check to see what was happening, braving the elements to do so. The men were waving desperately for help. Mm. And it became apparent when examined by telescope what was actually unfolding on the Mary Stuart.
And there was no such thing, of course, as lifeboats in Black Rock at that particular time. So they were using, for to get out, they were using very small little boats.
They were, of course.
And not trained or anything.
No, they weren't. I mean, there was no lifeboat service in Black Rock. These catastrophic events would change all that, Harry. But there was no and not alone that, it was customary for a boat or a bark of the Mary Stuart size, she had a crew of 18, to have a lifeboat. Now, that was never dealt with in any great detail in the initial articles in the Democrat, but had she had a lifeboat, the men could at least have got off onto the lifeboat and perhaps been towed away. But the lifeboats may have been damaged in the storm. She was buffeted about at a fear rate for the best part of a week.
So were these trained people that was going out to help, or were they just ordinary people
there were fishermen, certainly, and several of them had great experience. James Crosby, who would lose his life in the affair, and George Elphinstone were very experienced fishermen, and they knew the waters well, they fished for a living. They knew the tides, the whims and caprices of the deep and all this type of thing. 70 men, over 70, from all walks of life, were the charities, the businessmen, sailors, fishermen, surely dockers, coast guards and farmers, displayed extraordinary courage.
They were very brave men, weren't they?
They were. And this is what Captain Kelly went out, Captain Kelly's crew went out in a small, normal boat, a fishing boat. People were later on shocked that a man of Kelly's experience, he was 37, an experienced sailor, would have gone so, because a lifeboat would have had hulls on the side. The hulls on the side would have repelled the water. Kelly's boat was an open boat, and they were bailing water as they went.
But I suppose they were looking at this boat in trouble, and they hadn't got the equipment.
On the fatal, but there had been several attempts made over the period of a couple of days. And it was on the Friday, she ran aground on Tuesday, yes.
Because the weather was atrocious, wasn't it?
The weather was awful. It was one of the worst storms in living memory. But the weather, as I said, freezing gale force winds, floods, cold and rain. And that problem is that the men who, the less experienced and the younger sailors, were tied to the mast by the captain. But they were dying with cold and exposure and frostbite. A couple of them fell off the mast with weakness and were drowned. You know, and a couple of, as the week unfolded, a couple of men who had died with exposure had to be cast off the boat. And the men who were on the boat, their clothes were washed off them and everything. Yeah. One man had to take the trousers off another dead man to put over to put upon himself to try and keep warm. Their hands were numb. Their hands and knuckles were black with frostbite.
Yeah. And all some of these boats that went out to help.
It was only at the culmination of the week that Robert Shankey was the man who eventually got them off the boat.
Noel, how did the rescue attempts unfold?
Well, over the course of the week, from the Wednesday until the Friday, there had been several attempts. There were 11 attempts in all. But the awful events on Friday, the 9th of April, occurred when the storms were raging so fiercely off Soldiers Point that the captains of the Independence and the Earl of Erne met with the commander of the Coast Guards, and they said that if there was so much sea on the bar, plans were made to have the Independence go out to the Mary Stoddard that were scrapped. It was then they said, and this is again what tragedy occurred over there was a Dundalk Harbour paddle tug, the James Watt. Incredibly, she had engine trouble that could not be used. So Peter Russell drove by horse and cart to Blackrock, and he brought in George Alfredson and James Crosby to act as pilots for two lifeboats being launched off Soldiers Point. Now, both men were selected for their knowledge of the tides and the Fern River Channel. Crosby had a crew of 8 volunteers on his boat, including Captain James
Kelly.
These were the ones
that would have a chance of saving somebody.
And Kelly had decided to use the ship's boat from the Pride of Erden, his ship, for the rescue attempt. It wasn't a lifeboat and was thus more exposed to the waves. It was lighter and more easily rowed. But many men were astonished that a seaman of such experience as Kelly would go to sea in such woeful conditions in such a craft. Mm. Alfredson would later state that had he known that the James Watt engine wouldn't have started, he would have made the attempt from the Fern River Channel. He knew the Fern River Channel better than the waters at Soldiers Point. Whether this would have averted the tragedy that was about to unfold will never be known.
So James Crosby, he was a Black Rock man.
He
was a big part of the story.
Oh, yes. The Crosby family home was where the credit union is now situated. He had a brother and sister. He was born in 1832. The year he was born, there was a cholera epidemic in Black Rock. And
what happened to him then, Noel? How did he die?
He died from what's now known as hypothermia. James Crosby wasn't drowned. But what happened was that on nearing the Mary Stoddard, Crosby's boat was capsized. And Crosby and his crew were in the water for an estimated 15 and 20 minutes. This would thus be responsible for killing them. They would die with hypothermia and shock. Many of the men who were rescued were brought ashore in a woeful condition. Going out, I mean, Crosby had wanted to wait to make the attempt when the tide had ebbed. It had only half ebbed when the men went ahead. He was apparently overruled. It would have made more sense to go out when the tide had fully ebbed. Boats left the lighthouse around 10 a.m. The tide had only ebbed for about 2 hours. That this is the most dangerous type of tide to attempt to navigate in order to reach the stricken ship, because as the force of the ebb tide weakens, the waves would tend to peak less and become longer and thus easier to navigate had they waited. And this was the idea behind Crosby's dish. But there was still a strong ebb piling against gale force wind that was now creating very high waves coming very close together, waves to 10 and 12 foot high.
Yeah, so Noel, at the end of all the attempts and everything like that, there was 7 people died on the actual ship.
And 4 people drowned in the rescue attempt.
And 4, well, yeah.
Crosby's going out twice. Michael McArthur was thrown out of George Elphinstone's boat, and he had to be pulled back in by the armpits and by the hair on his head, by two of the hands, by James Morton and George Elphinstone. And they lost the Noah, which was a disaster because it impeded their steering. And Morton was also washed into the water head first, but he was pulled back by Captain Haynes, grabbing the belt of his trousers. So it was a suicide attempt going there.
Yeah. And where was Crosby at this time?
Crosby was in the other boat, and when they neared the Mary Stoddard, you're talking about 2 miles out to sea, when they neared the Mary Stoddard, a huge wave overturned Crosby's boat, and he and his crew were pitched into the sea. They were in the water for an estimated 15 to 20 minutes, and the lengthy exposure to frozen seas would be the main factor in killing them from shock and hypothermia.
But they got back into the boat, didn't they?
Yeah, another wave righted the boat again.
Oh, right,
and those that were able to were crawled back in and dragged in. Captain Kelly had been washed away by several yards. The last sightings of James Kelly, both at Black Rock and at Billorgan Point, witnesses who saw him last stated he was wearing very high leather boots above the knees. These would not have given him any chance and would have dragged them down. Indeed, when his body was discovered later, a couple of months later, there was one of his boots missing. And when his foot came out of one boot, he slowly rose to the surface. Crosby didn't die there and then. Captain Kelly did. The last words that the stricken crew heard was Kelly yelling, "Lord of mercy, look out for yourselves, boys." And then he sank, God rest him.
No, they were very brave people.
Oh, they were absolutely.
I mean, it's, when you,
I know.
You can. We are recording this actually in Black Rock, just probably a couple of hundred yards from where it all happened.
Oh, yes, Harry, yeah. And Elphinstone boat, we're all on board, still bailing water to stay afloat, now made its way to Crosby stricken vessel, and they managed to drag some of the crew members, with Patrick Callan and Thomas McCarroll, John Lamb and a conscious but dying Gerald Hughes into Elphinstone boat. Elphinstone boat was hugely overloaded and they were missing an oar. Elphinstone managed, despite the raging seas, to leap into the boat and hold James Crosby's head above the water. And they towed Crosby boat in. But for that, Crosby would have drowned there and then. As it was, there was another man, James Murphy, now laying dead in the boat. Mm-hmm. Again, how they made it to the shore of Black Rock is a miracle. The lifeboat was completely overloaded, as I said, and it lacked one oar. But they were assisted by a boat from the Enterprise, which had come out from Black Rock on another failed rescue attempt. And they assisted on towing them into Fane River Channel. They were brought in at Jack's Beach. It's where the Marine Court apartments are now built. Peter Russell, who brought George Elphinstone and Crosby to Dundalk that morning, had been watching the events from shore, and he rowed into Black Rock in order to have horses and traps brought up to the beach. So a frantic attempt must have been made to bring the stricken men ashore, and when they reached the shoal water and they attempted to get Crosby out of the boat, his hands were locked, frozen. They had an awful job to free his hands. He was still alive, Harry. Yeah, yeah, just. He was still alive. They brought him to Emily Cockshott's house, which is now was the promenade store, then it was the Black and Fruit and Veg Shop in recent years, and now it's a Salmon and Teacup. This would have been the first house that they came to. Mm-hmm. And they brought him there, and he was in a dying state. Emily Cockshott was the wife of Hargrave Cockshott, who was a grain merchant for Lord Claremont. And one of the things that we had to try and find in order to present the thing in the first place was to find out exactly where poor James Crosby died. We didn't know this. And there was 4 years earlier, in 1854, there was a land registry done, evaluation done, to evaluate rates on all the properties in Ireland. It was a massive undertaking. It was supervised by a Richard Griffith, as known as Griffith's Valuation. So you have all the houses, gardens and fields in Haggerton Parish and everywhere, every other parish in the country, north and south, evaluated for rates. So when I got my son Robert to blow up the accompanying maps which I bought in Dublin, it showed that Cockshott's are listed on the list as number 32. And there's a promontory of land running from facing Black Rock Church, where the Marine Court apartments were, where Uncle Tom's pub was, where the skating hall was, down to the promenade store. That bit of land had only two houses. One of them was a pub, Duffy's, and the other then was Cockshott's house. So that's where we nailed exactly where poor James was brought. They tried to revive poor James Crosby in Emily Cockshott's house. He was given hot milk, sups of brandy, depending on which periodicals you read. But he was in a dying state, and he was given the last rites by Father John Marmon. Now, given the fact that the parishes were then the United Parishes of Kilkerry and Haggerton, Father Marmon's house was at Rat Cottage, facing where the workhouse was built. It's very likely Father John Marmon would have been on the scene, prepared to administer such spiritual aid as would be required, because by this stage, all in the county knew what was unfolding at Black Rock. So he was on the scene. Captain James Kelly's funeral to Seaton is described as the largest funeral ever seen in the district. James Crosby would have had a huge funeral. They all would have had. And the maps at the time showed that the Sandy Lane, as we know it now, was then uncompleted. It was just sand dunes. There were a couple of houses up, you know, up on the hill there where the Neptune is now. There was nothing there from there to what we now know as the Rock Road. So they would have had to, it's very likely James Crosby's remains would have been brought to his family home in the village where Black Rock Credit Union is now situated. And the only way they would have went, there was no chapel in Black Rock at the time, and he would have been brought to Haggerton Chapel, just in the 40s. They would have gone over by Wallace's Road, that wouldn't have straight away, down to Jackie Murphy's, which was built down, and over the Chapel Road down, or they would have gone up to the Green Gates and down. But he would not have brought him by the Sandy Lane.
And no, at this stage now, how did they go back? Did the weather after 5 days completely stop and were able to go out to the Stellard.
The weather had abated somewhat, but the documentary attempts described a successful attempt by Edward Tipping, 6-oared yawl, which had left Belogan Point, that it faced enormous waves and were thrown away several times from the boat. They managed to get to the boat, and by throwing a rope over, some of the crew made their way onto the rescue boat. Shankey's boat, Shankey was the chief boatman of Giles's Quay, and had he not been, you know, such a well-versed expert at sea law, it's very likely that they wouldn't have succeeded. Shankey's crew had to drop away four times onto the treacherous seas. But each time they managed to reach the Mary Stothard again, and they got Captain Johnson and six others on their own small boat, which was overloaded with 12 men on board. You had six of a crew. But with great difficulty, they made it back to Belogan Shore in the difficult conditions. And Captain Hill and his first mate, Archibald Hugg, and two remaining crew members heroically decided to remain on the tattered mast of the Mary Stothard rather than risk overflowing the rescue boat. Incredibly, Shankey's overcrowded boat was some 2.5 miles from the nearest land. They made it back to Soldiers Point with high seas breaking over the boat. It was then 8 p.m. and the following morning, Shankey and his crew went out again and managed to get the rest of the crew off the boat.
What happened to the boat?
She later broke up. The estimated loss of the vessel was some £3,500 sterling. Some sails, ropes and spars were salvaged, and in 1908 at the Dundalk Show, a harbell and barometer and a deck light and a cabin panel were displayed. But there was very little of the boat left. And in recent years, Charlie and Eamon Carroll had late 1960s, had noticed there was a heavy chain at the spot where she ran aground, had been exposed at ebb tide. But there were some timber. It's thought that probably the remains of the Mary Stothard, but as the mouth shifted annually, when Charlie went back a couple of years later, they were gone.
Now, they hadn't a lifeboat at that time during all of that, and was it because of that and the loss of life that they did get then a lifeboat for Blackrock?
Oh, yes, there was a lifeboat house established at Blackrock in 1859, 12 months after the disaster. And immediately on the disaster occurring, Lord Clement, Thomas Fortescue, he was a very, very good landlord. He never gets the credit he deserves. But Thomas Fortescue commissioned a lifeboat house to be built. And initially it was built where the Cahill Inn apartments now are, beside where the pavilion was there situated. The problem with it was, although many successful rescue attempts were made, it was very far out from the Fane River channel in times of emergency. And local farmers kept harness horses in readiness to drag the boat out. In 1900, it was decided more expedient to build a lifeboat house out at the mouth of the Fane River. They literally only have to go a few yards from where the lifeboat house was built. So that was the idea of moving it out to there.
You know. Worst, Noel, coming towards the end of our little chat now, what is the lasting legacy of what happened? A few monuments around,
yes,
isn't there?
Of
like
course
Kelly's
there is,
monument
yes. The lasting legacy of all these things is bravery. The bravery of the fishermen who went out on the rescue attempt, the fortitude of the men on the boat who were marooned there, who stayed there, and the way a whole community pulled together. We're finding that now at the present day. You know, but the way the whole community pulled together, who men from all walks of life, risked life and limb, to try and bring those men ashore. Mm-hmm. Crosby hadn't, not that he hadn't wanted to go, he was wary of going until the tide ebbed, yet he went. Mm-hmm. Twice on the way out, the men were thrown out of the boat and dragged back in again, yet they went on.
There was a report about the whole thing in the Democrat at the time, and they ended up by saying that they should not have gone out.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. There's a report in the Democrat to the effect that no one doubted these men's courage. But the effort, we repeat, in such conditions and with such awful waves and conditions prevailing was far too much. And no one should have attempted to go out.
I doubt if people of their bravery could stand looking out at the ship and the trouble that it was in without trying to help.
No, they couldn't. No. The attempts by the men to rescue the crew of the Mary Stothard were the bravest efforts ever made by any people from this village. They really were. And I do think that there should be, the houses are built, I've mentioned this in several quarters, that there should be an Elphinstone estate and a Crosby Close to commemorate these men.
It has the makings of a wonderful movie, hasn't it?
It has. It has the makings of a wonderful movie. Yeah. It has. The week after the initial brochures were printed, I just came up with a short poem. It's not in the brochure, but I'll read it just
to
tell you. It's very short. I meant for Captain Kelly's crew. In the mind you are forever rowing, moving slowly outwards from the shore, buffeted by the storm winds blowing and deafened by the ocean's roar. In the mind you are forever going, riding upon each wave, swell and dip, bravely, recklessly, defiantly knowing the difficulty of taking the crew from that stricken ship. In the mind the sea is forever gloating at your upturned boat and each lost oar, and at your broken body floating, then being washed up upon the shore. In the mind you are forever frozen, blue and drowned in the bitter cold. In the mind you are forever chosen to be remembered, but never to grow old.
Noel Kenny, thank you very much indeed.
Lovely to see you again, Harry, and thank you very much for
again. I really enjoyed it, and I hope anyone listening to it will get a better feel of it now rather than reading it in paper. You know,
please, I hope I've done the story some justice. Thank you, Harry. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Noel.